At a casualty clearing station behind the lines, British Tommies knew that you'd be bandaged, you'd be dosed up with morphine, and hopefully mended. So when it came to naming three locations where these CCSs would be brought together for the momentous year of 1917 at Ypres, they called them Bandageham, Dozingham, and Mendingham. We've returned to Flanders for this episode, but not in the front line. We're behind the lines, behind the front at Ypres, close to the town of Poperinge. Poperinge, or Pops to the troops, was a place where from 1915 the British Army used the town as its main base for its operations in those battles and holding the line around the Belgian city of Ypres. Prior to 1915, Poperinge had been part of the French rear echelon, where they'd had their base, and that is visible even today with cemeteries and sites connected with the French story of their battles in Flanders. But it's a later period largely that we're going to look at in this podcast, particularly associated with the year 1917 and the Third Battle of Ypres, because Poperinge by then was not just a town, the civilians were still living in it, but it was a base, a proper base, and a camp for the British Army. And not within the town itself. In the early years of the war, the British Army had experimented with billeting troops with civilians in Poperinge. And although there had been many happy occasions in which that had worked, there had been some where rough, tough Tommies had broken things and stamped their dirty, muddy boots all over people's private property. So the army increasingly began to build camps around Poperinge. First, tented camps. They brought over army tents, some of which were probably had been used for Kitchener's army or the territorials in the early phase of the First World War. And then civilian contractors were brought over to build camps, as well as the army, the Royal Engineers, building camps. And gradually, this whole kind of network of camps built up around the town of Poperinge. Some of them with wooden huts, and then later on in the war, they were using the Nissen huts. Designed by Major Nissen, these half-moon shapes, corrugated iron kind of structures were visible all around Poperinge by 1917, and you can see them in many of the photographs of that period. So it was a place where troops were gathered to go up the line to get ready for offensives. There were ammunition and supply depots all around Poperinge. There were road networks that were carefully constructed. They even built a switch road around Poperinge so the traffic could move more fluidly and there was no congestion on the roads, particularly when the Germans obviously were shelling it or bombing it, as they did quite substantially around Poperinge in the later period of the First World War, bombing it from the air with small kind of tactical bombers, but also the larger Gotha bombers as well that flew over and bombed the British Army's infrastructure around its main base town in Flanders, the town of Poperinge. So there were camps, there were ammunition supply depots, there were training areas, and there were also medical facilities, because as soldiers marched up to the front, particularly to take part in a major battle, there would be casualties, and those casualties were not just men killed in action on the battlefield. The majority of the casualties were wounded, and in quiet periods, particularly in the winter, the casualties were men who were sick through service in the front line with trench forts, with all kinds of illnesses that were caused by protracted exposure to damp conditions or snow or extreme cold. So as well as having places to billet troops, you also needed medical facilities to treat the wounded and the sick. And all around Poperinge, in the little hamlets and the little farmsteads that surrounded the town, these medical establishments, which in this area would have been casualty clearing stations, and we'll come to the kind of structure of evacuation in a moment, they were established. Some of them within, as we said, farmsteads, existing areas of buildings. The Remy siding at what became Lissenherk is a good example of that, just to the west of Poperinge. But then specifically constructed casualty clearing stations were also built, particularly in the lead up to Third Ypres, where it was recognised that there could be a substantial level of casualties and you needed multiple facilities, multiple casualty clearing stations to cope with the wounded coming in. So Poperinge, probably more than any other main town, perhaps Bethune just behind it, for a substantial period of the war became one of the most important locations in the positions behind the front line for the British Expeditionary Force. So that's British and all of the other Commonwealth nations besides. It became one of the most important locations because those British and Commonwealth Empire forces, as they were then, were here for the longest period compared to Bethune, compared to Albert, for example, down on the Somme, which was an important town in 1916 and then again to a lesser degree in 1918. But Poperinger remained a kind of pinnacle location in terms of how the British Army conducted its battles, in terms of resupply, sending troops up to the front line, training men to get ready for battle, and then dealing with the consequences of conflict, of battle, which were the casualties. So it became a place that pretty much every soldier that served in Flanders, for one reason or another, whether it was a place that they slept, where they trained, where they marched through to go up to the front, or where they were brought back to when they were gassed or wounded or went sick, it was a place that they knew very well. And there are so many facets to life, wartime life in Poperinger, that we could fill lots and lots of podcasts with those. We've done a little bit on some of those before, and I'm sure we will return to that in due course. Talbot House, the place that soldiers went to get away from the war, where the TOC-H organisation began in 1915, that's a good example of that. But that's not what we're discussing today. We're looking at those casualty clearing stations. So let's remind ourselves of how soldiers were evacuated from a battlefield. So when a unit went into attack, and an infantry battalion, it had its own regimental stretcher bearers. Now, these were not conscientious objectors. There were very few Royal Army medical personnel attached to an infantry battalion. There would be the regimental medical officer, the battalion medical officer, the RMO or the BMO, or just the MO, the medical officer. Those are the common abbreviations that you see in, for example, war diaries connected to the story of medical officers and serving in these infantry battalions. Now, under his command, he might have one or two orderlies from the Royal Army Medical Corps in his stretcher bearer section, but most of the stretcher bearers were infantry soldiers who had volunteered for stretcher bearer duties. Now, that meant that at any point, if they were no good at it, for example, they could be transferred back into a rifle platoon. So if you were a conscientious objector, what were you doing in an infantry battalion in the first place? And you're not going to want to be transferred back to the ranks of an infantry section, platoon, company, whatever, so this is not the place for you. So it's kind of a myth, really, that stretcher bearers in an infantry battalion were COs, conscientious objectors. But this stretcher bearer unit with the medical officer, and by 1917, which was the year that largely concerns us in this podcast, America had now entered the war, and a lot of American medical officers were sent to British units to serve as regimental medical officers or to serve in field ambulances and casualty clearing stations. And you see a lot of mention of this during, in particular, in this 1917, early 1918 period. And they gained a lot of useful experience that could then be applied to the American Expeditionary Force when they began their big battles on the Western Front in 1918. So you're a Tommy going over the top in a battle of 1917. You get wounded and one of your battalion stretcher bearers picks you up, takes you to the RAP, the Regimental Aid Post, where that medical officer will be to assess your wounds. He'll redress the wounds. The men who've picked you up probably have put a first field dressing on you, cleaned the wound as much as they could in the conditions of the battlefield, brought you to the Regimental Aid Post. The medical officer will do his job. He'll also suss out whether you're going to be suitable to be evacuated any further back or whether he can treat you there. But sadly, many men, that was as far as they got, the Regimental Aid Post. They had such catastrophic wounds that at the time, although British medical facilities were pretty good and there'd been a lot of advances in medicine, if a man came in having lost multiple limbs or had a very serious stomach wounds, the medical officer had to make a decision as to whether that soldier was going to survive evacuation or not. And he wanted to prioritise the ones that had a good chance of survival. So it was a tough job as a regimental battalion level medical officer, kind of having to play God when these men were brought in with these terrible wounds that the industrial war that the First World War had turned into caused. So that was your first port of call. So if you were treated by the medical officer, your wound redressed, you put on a stretcher, you're handed over then to the Royal Army Medical Corps. So you're moving away from the infantry level stretcher bearers to the stretcher bearers of the REMC. And they're coming from a field ambulance, of which there's three of those in every division, and they'll have set up a main dressing station, or more commonly, an advanced dressing station, an ADS. And you're then taken there, and further medical officers look at you when you come in, redress your wounds, clean them up again, and then decide where you're going to go to next. And the next port of call after that was a CCS, a casualty clearing station. And a typical dressing station, advanced or main dressing station, would then have a cab rank of ambulances outside it from the CCS, where casualties would be loaded up into those, and then they would either be motorised ambulances or horse-drawn ambulances, and they would then be taken back further to the casualty clearing station. So the regimental aid post is on the battlefield, the advanced dressing station is just behind the battlefield, and when you're taken from there to a CCS, it's several miles behind the front line. And if we look at the kind of CCSs, the casualty clearing stations that existed in this kind of orbit around Poperinger, they are 7-8 miles or so from the frontline area, depending on what stage of the fighting of 1917 was taking place at that time. So when you got to a casualty clearing station, that's where you'd find specialist doctors. So not just general medical officers, these were men who were specialists in particular areas of medicine. And that's where you'd find surgeons who would carry out operations. So a casualty clearing station covered around about a square mile of ground. It had operating theatres. It had the facilities to do blood transfusion. It had X-ray facilities. And this is also the place where you would first encounter military nurses, either from the Imperial Nursing Service or from the Voluntary Aid Detachment, the VADs. And they served in these CCSs. So that was the kind of nearest point that most women got to the front line. So women were not going forward as stretcher bearers, not driving ambulances up to the trenches. They were in this area slightly away from the main battlefield, but as we will discover, they were not entirely safe there. So this was a proper field hospital, basically. It was a mini field hospital, a casualty clearing station, where men would be brought in, having essentially just been patched up. And here they would have their dirty clothes and equipment removed, their wound properly cleaned and dressed and assessed. And then if they required an operation or further treatment or an X-ray to see if bones had been broken or a blood transfusion, all of that could be done here. And then they would be treated here and they would rehabilitate here as well before perhaps being moved back via an ambulance train to a base hospital somewhere on the French coast. The history of the Canadian Army Medical Service is a really interesting and useful volume which you can find on the Internet Archive, the Gutenberg Project, to download for free. It gives us a bit of an insight into what a typical casualty clearing station looked like in terms of what the facilities were. It says, "It was agreed that every casualty clearing station should in future be equipped with two huts, each 60 feet long, one for operating and one for dressing. The operation hut was to be divided into three rooms, one for surgery, with space for three operating tables. Before the end, as many as 12 tables were installed in these huts. Two new departments were added. First, a resuscitation ward, where the grievously wounded were treated for shock. Secondly, a pre-operation ward, where all the soiled clothes were removed before the men reached theatre. The clearing stations were placed on sidings so that ambulance trains could come to the door. As a rule, two or three casualty clearing stations were grouped together and received wounded in rotation." So bearing that in mind and the thought that there was this whole kind of orbit, as we've said, of casualty clearing stations around Poperinger in 1917 and they were grouped together, there was a group in some very small hamlets just to the north of Poperinger where casualty clearing stations were specifically set up for the forthcoming offensive in the summer of 1917, and that offensive being the Third Battle of Ypres, or the Battle of Passchendaele, as it's often called. And these were in rural locations near to woodland or small collections of farm buildings or close to little villages, and they were given nicknames by the men. When you're brought to a casualty clearing station, you're treated, you're bandaged by the medical orderlies. You're dosed, you're given morphine, and you're mended, you're treated. So, laconically, the men of the British Expeditionary Force, the Tommies in the front line, called these areas Bandage'em, Dozing'em, and Mending'em. You were bandaging them, you were dosing them, and you were mending them if you were sent there. And the H-E-M, G-H-E-M, at the end of each of those words was a play on many of the locations that you find in Flanders that have actual names that end with that phrase. So a group of casualty clearing stations named Bandage'em, Dozing'em, and Mending'em, the official titles, and you see this mentioned in the official medical histories and the documents, the war diaries of the time, were brought together, and some of the numbered casualty clearing stations were then posted to those. So in the lead up to the Third Battle of Ypres at Mending'em, near to Proven, numbers 12, 46 and 64 casualty clearing stations were there, and they broke each area up into receiving particular types of casualties. So at Mending'em, they were to receive gas casualties, many had been gassed in the front line, head injuries, sick from certain areas, walking wounded from other certain areas, and walking wounded that were brought to specific places that could be picked up by motor ambulances and brought direct to the casualty clearing station. And the idea was that if you gave each casualty clearing station area a specific task with types of wounds or types of casualties, then the whole lot wouldn't be overwhelmed by a mass of different injuries coming in and the medical officers struggling to treat them. So Mending'em did that. Dozing'em was to receive all wounded that were being brought in by motorised ambulances. Then sick who'd been found on the battlefield area and brought in. But they also, one of their specialities were eye injuries and cases of men who'd been gassed and were not yet diagnosed what type of gas it was, because we're moving through a period in which new types of gases were being introduced, with mustard gas, for example, just round the corner. So Dozing'em and Mending'em were for specific types of injuries, as detailed, and that information comes from the medical history, which outlines what each casualty clearing station area was doing, getting prepared for in that lead up to the Third Battle of Ypres. At Bandage'em, they were just dealing with sick cases, so men who were sick on the battlefields, because although it was the summer, men would still get sick, there would be sick coming in from the front line, and rather than just general sickness, if it was an epidemic of a particular kind of sickness, you wouldn't want that to spread through a general ward of men with battle injuries, because it could hasten their death, for example. So Bandage'em was used to receive those type of casualties. So we see this quite a sophisticated approach to triaging, dealing with casualties coming back from the front line, to separate them out, send them to specific areas to ensure their survivability. And that is why by the end of the war, the British and Empire, Commonwealth medical facilities on the battlefields were amongst the best, and your chances of surviving a wound or sickness on the front line was pretty high. But it wasn't possible to save everybody. And one of the greatest killers on the battlefields in the First World War generally was infection. With no antibiotics, when a soldier came in with an infected wound, it could kill him. And we see testimony to this, where each casualty clearing station was located on these rear areas behind the front line of the First World War, we will always find cemeteries, British and Commonwealth cemeteries, where soldiers, sadly, died of their wounds. And in addition to that, we mentioned how the Germans bombed areas around Poperinger during that 1917 period. So if we just look at Dozing'em, for example, number 4 casualty clearing station and number 47 casualty clearing station, who were there in August of 1917, both got hit during this period of bombing, where the Germans were trying to bomb ammunition and supply depots, but the bombs missed and hit medical facilities. They, for example, in one raid lost 4 officers and 4 other ranks wounded, and in another raid they lost 1 officer, 1 sister, that's a nurse, and 28 other ranks wounded. And number 47th casualty clearing station in one raid alone had 14 other ranks killed. So these were patients in the CCS that got killed as bombs hit the buildings. 7 medical officers wounded, 2 nurses wounded, and 45 other ranks wounded as well. So that was quite a serious raid that led to a lot of casualties. So when we think about how the history of that period and the history of these casualty clearing stations reflects on the landscape as it is today, all of these CCSs covered large areas during the Great War, and many had substantial semi-permanent looking buildings, but nothing of those survives today except their cemeteries. So as we said, when soldiers died of their wounds, they were buried in cemeteries close to the casualty clearing stations, and those invented names of those three CCS locations from 1917, Bandageham, Dozingham and Mendingham, now are immortalized in three cemeteries of that name. They're preserved forever in stone at the entrances. So let's explore them. Our first phase of the journey takes us on a road heading north out of Popperinger towards the little village of Krombeke. Before we get there, we passed by the La Louvie Chateau, which was a headquarters during the Great War, and we come up into a wooded area near to the St. Sixtus Abbey, an abbey now not famous for its religious order, which still lives there, but more so for its beer, which is served in many of the cafes and bars in Popperinger and Ypres and the wider area. Now, this used to be one of the most difficult cemeteries to get to. In the days before the internet, the Wargraves Commission issued a series of Michelin maps in which there were little purple dots showing the location of cemeteries, and you could use these maps to find the cemetery that you were looking for. Dozingham was marked incorrectly, as I found out in the summer of 1986 when I went there, and I couldn't find it. It wasn't where the map said it was. And I ended up at the St. Sixtus Abbey, who the monks there, despite their vow of silence, managed to find somebody who could speak to me, and they were able to tell me exactly where the cemetery was. Now, today it's a lot easier with Google Maps, and we'll put maps of where these different cemeteries are onto the podcast website, oldfrontline.co.uk, and there's a link in the show notes for this, taking you straight to the episode page for this episode of the Old Front Line. And of course, there are cemetery signs, and the cemetery sign on this road, as you come north out of Popperinger towards Krombeke, come into this wooded area, and there is a green sign taking you down a little track through the trees, and you come out into a clearing, and that's where the cemetery is located. It's quite a large cemetery, a large burial ground, and if we look at the open fields that surround it, we're looking into the area where the casualty clearing stations were located. There were wooden huts there, and when we look at trench maps or the Great War digital trench maps that we can look at on Linesman, for example, we can see that there was a massive kind of network of facilities in this area close to the woods where we are now as we emerge from those and come to the cemetery. And at the cemetery entrance, we see the first of those made-up Flemish names given to these groups of casualty clearing stations immortalised in stone on the entrance to the cemetery, Dozingham Military Cemetery. So this, like all of the ones that we're going to look at, were cemeteries that were largely established in the lead-up to the Third Battle of Ypres. The cemetery here was made in June of 1917, when the casualty clearing stations began to set up and get prepared for the forthcoming attack. The history of the cemetery states that the 61st, 2nd South Midland casualty clearing station was the first to arrive to occupy this site here at Dozingham. And on the 5th of June 1917, it arrived by railway at the nearby village of Proven, having travelled up from the Somme sector. It opened to admit wounded to the casualty clearing station about a week later, and then it was also used for infectious cases coming back from the frontline area. One of its specialities, as we've mentioned previously also, it was used to treat men with eye injuries. That type of surgery, the treatment operations on eyes, was something that was not exactly in its infancy, but it was kind of an early stage, and a lot of lessons were learnt from the experience of such injuries during the Great War. You can imagine with shrapnel going off in a close confined area, whether a hand grenade or a mortar round or a shell, then iron fragments would quite commonly get in soldiers' eyes, and they needed to be taken out to stop the soldier losing that eye or losing his sight. And all of that kind of advancement was begun in places like this, where hard-pressed surgeons had to deal with lots of cases of that type of injury coming in, particularly as the war got more and more industrialised and shelling and artillery became such an important part and a significant part of the battle and the soldiers' experience, and most soldiers being killed or wounded by artillery fire by the end of the First World War. So when we look at the actual cemetery as we open the gate and go in, it is a large burial ground. There's over 3,300 burials here. And when we break that down into the different nationalities, there's 3,057 British soldiers, 81 Canadians, 65 Germans, we'll come back to that in a minute, 15 South Africans, 14 New Zealanders, 6 Australians, bringing the total to 3,238. There are some Second World War casualties here as well. There was some fighting in this area in 1940, and there are 67 World War II burials, largely from 1940, right by the entrance as you first go into the cemetery. Now, we mentioned German burials there, 65 German burials. So these were prisoners of war that were brought in wounded off the battlefields of 1917 and early 1918. From memory, I think they're pretty much all 1917. And they were treated by British or Canadian or Australian medics on the battlefield. The Germans did the same when British wounded who'd been captured on the battlefield were brought in. That reciprocal treatment of the wounded was very, very commonplace. So these were Germans that were brought in and they were treated in the casualty clearing station here. I think by 1917 they began to put them in separate wards because some British soldiers didn't want to be treated alongside the Jerries. And I remember one Great War veteran telling me during the period of the Battle of the Somme, he ended up in a hospital behind the lines where he woke up and he said, "You'll never bloody believe it, I woke up next to a bloody Jerry." And of course, soldiers were there to fight and kill the enemy. And it was a bit of a kind of culture shock to them to wake up alongside a combatant of the other side of no man's land. And we perhaps now tend to think that there was a great camaraderie between soldiers on the battlefields of different sides. And there was Christmas 1914, we saw that, and quite a few other instances besides. But generally, not so. Perhaps in later years, when they look back and when they met veterans in the interwar period or later on in their lives. But I think during the war itself, that was kind of less, that sentiment was less common. So these Germans, having been treated, sadly, like British soldiers, they too perhaps have got infected wounds and they've died of their wounds and they were buried in a separate plot within the cemetery. So their graves are quite easy to find. And you see that in a lot of medical cemeteries in the First World War, separate plots, sometimes separate plots for officers or for nurses or for Germans or for Jewish soldiers or for black soldiers. That's very common. The kind of further you get from the battlefield, the less of kind of communal burials you see, and that the old kind of class structure of Britain is sometimes reflected in those burial grounds. And what we see as we walk along those rows of graves is that they reflect the fighting in those early stages of the Third Battle of Ypres. So you'll find men whose date of death is the 31st of July 1917, the first day of that battle, who've been brought back from the attacks across the Pilkelm Ridge, for example, and brought from the regimental aid posts on the battlefield there to dressing stations near to Bosinger, perhaps Essex Farm, and then brought by motorised ambulance here to Dozingham and then died of their wounds. And as the battle moves on, with the crossing of the Steenbeck River and the attacks on Langemark and Polkapel, you see that reflected in the burials here as well. And when you kind of look at the cap badges, you begin to see the order of battle of different units that pass through those different sectors. So Welsh troops, Guards Division, 29th Division, later on the Irish troops crossing the Steenbeck. You see all of that kind of reflected in the burials. And in these big cemeteries, there's over 3,000 graves in here. Sometimes it's difficult to kind of focus on something and find your way. There's so many names to look at because there are no unidentified soldiers from the First World War, men having died in a medical facility. They had their pay books in their pockets, their dog tags around their neck, their personal possessions and papers on them. So they were identifiable soldiers. And we're looking, when we examine these graves, it gives us quite a good cross-section of the kind of men that were serving in infantry or other units during that Third Battle of Ypres period. But there's no unknowns. They're all identified soldiers. So where to start? Now, what brought me to this cemetery on that date in 1986 when I got lost trying to find the place was a visit to a particular grave, the grave of a gunner officer who was the brother of one of my closest veteran friends that I was interviewing on a regular basis at that time, the veterans of the Great War, and several of those became very good friends. And one of them, who I've mentioned a lot in this podcast, Malcolm Vivian, this was where his brother was buried. And that's why I was making my journey here in 1986, when he was still alive, to photograph and visit the grave on his behalf. Malcolm Vivian was not your kind of ordinary Tommy. He was from quite a privileged background. He was one of three brothers who were born in the late 1880s and 1890s. The brothers were Hugh, Beresford and Malcolm. He was the youngest. And later they had a sister, Gertrude, who was born in 1906. The family home was in Penarth in Glamorganshire. That's where they grew up, but they also had a house in London. And the family connection, the Vivians, V-Y-V-Y-A-N, were the oldest Cornish family, and that's where their roots were. There was a house in Cornwall called Trelawarren, which was the family home. Malcolm had visited it a few times, but he'd never lived in it. They lived in Wales or in London. And as I mentioned, that Malcolm was not from a typical family. They were wealthy, they were privileged. His mother, Constance, she was born in New York City, so she was an American. And his father, Hugh Senior, was a wealthy shipping broker. So he'd gone, as all the brothers had done, they'd gone to private school and then gone off to university. Malcolm had been educated at Cambridge just before the Great War, and he'd enlisted from Cambridge when the war broke out in 1914. Malcolm joined the Glamorganshire Royal Garrison Artillery. Having been brought up in Glamorganshire, he got a commission in the local territorial RGA unit, which eventually became the 96th Siege Battery RGA, and he served with them on the Western Front from 1916. The eldest brother, Hugh, had originally served with the Scots Guards, then he got a commission in the Duke of Cornwall's Light Infantry and went right through the Great War, being awarded the Military Cross. And the middle brother, Beresford, one that Malcolm was particularly close to, joined the Royal Field Artillery as a driver in 1914, and then he was commissioned into the Royal Field Artillery shortly afterwards, crossing to France in September of 1915 and then transferring to the 121st Brigade Royal Field Artillery that was part of the 38th Welsh Division, and he was a forward observer for their attack on Mametz Wood, for example, in July of 1916, and then they moved up to the battlefields around Ypres during that winter of 1916-17 and then prepared for the attack on Pilcombe Ridge as part of the Third Battle of Ypres in July of 1917. He'd been mentioned in dispatches for his bravery on the Somme in 1916, but his war ended in Flanders when he received a fatal wound acting as a forward observer up onto the battlefields. An interesting little aside to this, many years ago, I think for the 90th anniversary of the Third Battle of Ypres, I led a ledger tour and had a farmer from Yorkshire whose father had been a gunner officer in the First World War and had kept really detailed diaries, and he'd brought the 1917 volume with him. And when he showed it to me, he'd served in the same unit as Beresford Vivian. And there was Beresford mentioned in the diaries. Sadly, this chap was going to get these diaries because they were incredibly detailed, really good account of service on the Western Front from the Somme through to the end of the war, get them published. But that has not happened as far as I know. Hopefully, one day they'll emerge again and they'll be in print. And it's amazing, really, how those kind of coincidences come about. I've got to a point where I don't really believe in coincidence anymore. Of all of the artillery units, and there were hundreds on the Western Front during the First World War, of all of the artillery units that this chap's father could have served in and he could have kept his diaries related to, it happened to be one that I had a connection to through Malcolm Vivian with his brother Beresford. And it's Beresford's grave as we walk up to his headstone, Captain Beresford Horton Vivian of the Royal Field Artillery, who died of wounds here at the Dozingham Casualty Clearing Station. It's his grave that we're standing in front of now. Now, my trip here in 1986 was to visit the grave on behalf of Malcolm, take some photographs, but also try and inspire him to perhaps come and visit the grave himself. He tried to do it when he'd been up on the Flanders coast in 1917, but never got an opportunity to come down to Poperinge to visit the cemetery. And it was something that he regretted, but I just couldn't push him across that line where he felt comfortable, able to visit the battlefields. He kind of wanted, he said, to remember them as they were, the darkness, the flares, the night time on the Western Front. and the smashed landscapes that he saw again and again during his experiences on those battlefields, he kind of didn't want to see it as it was today. And despite the pull of his brother's grave, wasn't quite enough to get him across. And that was a great shame. I would have loved to have visited some of these places, because I also found a site up at Pervis where he'd been in 1917, where there was an observation post tower which he'd used as his OP during that period. So I'm not sure he'd better climb up the ladder again and get in there in his late 80s, early 90s, but it would have been good to stand there in front of it with him and talk about that. Sadly, that never happened. So coming here in 86 for that first occasion became the first and one of many, many times since that I've come here, not just to remember Beresford, but in a wider way to remember Malcolm and all that he stood for as well, to act as kind of his conduit for the remembrance of his favourite brother and the brother that remains here for all time in Flanders Fields. Interestingly, the cross, the original wooden cross that stood on this grave, still survives. Beresford's original battlefield cross is in the churchyard at Rouen Minor in Cornwall. Their uncle was the local vicar of Rouen Minor during the Great War, and for some reason why it never went to Penarth where they lived, the cross went there instead, and it remains there to this day. There's the Return from the Fronts project with a really good website that lists these crosses that were brought back and placed in churches and houses and other memorial sites. And it's on there. You can see some photographs of it. I'll put a link to that on the podcast website so you can see it. And if you're ever in that part of Cornwall, you can pop in and see Beresford's cross and have a little nod to him and to Malcolm. Malcolm used to go to Rouen Minor quite a lot. He later moved to Saltash in Cornwall. And up until the death of his uncle, he visited him on a regular basis. He told me once that his uncle was collecting for the poor, and Malcolm gave him his greatcoat and his flea bag, his sleeping bag that he'd had in the trenches, a kind of Great War recycling going on there in some ways. But coming back to the cross, it's kind of nice to think that, and I often say this, the Great War is all around us when we're at home in Great Britain and probably many other places besides Australia and Canada. I know there's many kind of memorials and memorial sites and bits of the old battlefield that went back there, whether it's artillery pieces, trench mortars, helmets, or in some cases crosses from the battlefields too. And it's nice to think that the Great War, we can reach out and touch it, connect to it at home, and then connect to those objects out on the battlefields. But Beresford is not the only casualty buried here as well. Another one that I've been to visit on a few occasions is Major James Brown Montgomery Fleming. He was in the 6th Pioneer Battalion of the East Yorkshire Regiment. They were pioneers to an infantry division, and he died of wounds on the 18th of August 1917, aged 33. He was a Scot from Glasgow, educated at Glasgow University, where he'd studied law, and he was from a family of solicitors. He'd enlisted as a private in the Sportsman's Battalion of the Royal Fusiliers in 1914, which was a battalion drawn from men who had connections to sport. They were either professional sportsmen or amateurs, kind of semi-professional. And he joined them because he was a keen footballer and athlete, and he played football for Tottenham Hotspur before the First World War. He was also, his obituary says, a keen student of nature. And you remember we did a podcast about birds on the Western Front and how soldiers stood in the trenches and watched the birds on the wire and the migratory birds flying over the battlefields and birds nesting in the old overgrown no man's land. And I kind of like to think of him doing that every time that I stand at his grave here. And he'd had an opportunity to see birds on more than one kind of battlefield, because he'd served with the 6th East Yorks at Gallipoli in 1915 and then on the Somme in the fighting at Mouquet Farm. He'd been promoted major and he was wounded at Langemark in the fighting there and died of wounds here at Dozingham CCS. Now, amongst the nursing personnel that served here in 1917 was an American nurse called Nurse Helen Fairchild. She was part of the US Army Reserve. She was from Pennsylvania, born in 1884. And like there were American medical officers serving as medical officers in infantry battalions or as medical officers at casualty clearing stations, there were American nurses serving in medical units, which were part of the British Expeditionary Force as well. And she'd originally served at one of the base hospitals at Le Treport And then in July 1917, she volunteered to come up and serve as a surgical nurse for the British medical units here at Dozingham, attached to No. 4 Casualty Clearing Station. When the CCS was bombarded in August of 1917 and came under fire, she was one of those that was evacuated back to the base hospitals. The army was fearful of nurses getting killed, having several of them wounded. And just down the road, Nellie Spindler was killed in one of the casualty clearing stations at Brandhurk. So they evacuated them back to base hospitals, and she served there up until her death in January of 1918. Her chaplain wrote, "She died from her work at the front." And as we discussed in some recent episodes about American cemeteries from the Great War, the families had a choice of repatriation back to the United States or burial in the country theatre of war where the servicemen or woman had died. And in this case, Helen Fairchild, her family opted for her to be buried in France. So she's buried at the Somme American Cemetery, and will no doubt return to her story when we visit that cemetery in a future podcast. For now, we'll leave the wooded glade that Dozingham Cemetery sits in behind, and we'll head off to our next cemetery at Mendingham. Travelling to Mendingham Cemetery, we go through Proven, which was the site of headquarters during the Third Battle of Ypres. We go past International, or close to International, Corner, which was the main route for traffic and ambulances going to and from the frontline area. The junction was marked with a painted road sign on the end, the gable end of a farm building, which was there up until the 1990s. On that trip that I first came to visit Dozingham in 1986, I went to visit International Corner and photographed the gable end of the building with the sign still visible. Sadly, it was demolished in the 90s and no longer exists. Shame that that wall was not saved. And it takes us through the kind of rural countryside, and we get a flavour really of what this landscape looked like. It's changed very little since the time of the First World War. This is an area where we see little farmsteads and small villages and individual buildings and wooded areas that surround them, and big open fields, a lot of which had hops growing in them and still have hops in them to this day. And coming off the road to the village of Rosebrugge, this is where we find Mendingham Cemetery. It's tucked away down a little side road and leads you up to the front entrance. And there's some modern farm buildings close by to it. And then you're in this quite substantial cemetery. These casualty clearing station cemeteries are never small, really, because of the scale of casualties that were admitted and the percentage of men that were dying of their wounds. And this one predates the other two that we're looking at in this podcast, in that the 46 1st Wessex Casualty Clearing Station opened their doors at Proven for casualties in July of 1916, and the first burials took place in the cemetery in August of that year. But for the key period of July 1917, in the lead up to Third Ypres, it became part of that group of CCSs at Bandingham, Dozingham, and here at Mendingham. And a number of casualty clearing stations were brought in, 46th, 12th and 64th CCS being some of them who stayed here until 1918. When the front lines got a bit closer to Ypres in 1918 following the German offensives, it moved from being a CCS location, the casualty clearing station was moved further back, and then field ambulances took over some of the same buildings and huts, and they operated as an advanced dressing station in this area. So some of the casualties that are buried in here from that period are buried much nearer to the actual battlefield where they were mortally wounded. Burials totaled 2,443, and again, when we break that down, there's 2,292 British burials, 33 South African, 31 Canadians, 15 Australians, 12 New Zealanders. Because of being nearer to the battlefields in 1918, there are 8 unknown British and Commonwealth soldiers amongst them. And just as with Dozingham, German wounded were brought in here, and some of those died of their wounds. And there's 52 Germans buried in the cemetery, one of which is unknown. Buried in a slightly separate grave here, and one of the reasons which many people travel to this cemetery to see this grave, is the grave of Lieutenant Colonel Bertram Best Dunkley, VC. He was the commanding officer of the 2nd 5th Battalion of the Lancashire Fusiliers, and he died of wounds on the 5th of August 1917 aged 27, right at the beginning of the Third Battle of Ypres. His Victoria Cross was awarded for bravery at Wiltshire when his unit, part of the 55th West Lancashire Division, made the attack in that area. He wasn't that far away from the Liverpool Scottish, which included Noel Chavasse, who was about to be awarded a posthumous bar to his Victoria Cross for the fighting there in that early stage of Third Ypres. So the award of his Victoria Cross was for bravery in leading his battalion into action on that first phase of the offensive. And one account describes him complacently advancing with a walking stick in his hand as calmly as if he was walking across a parade ground. This was a man who seemingly had no fear. He'd set up his command post as the advance moved forward in a position known as Spree Farm. And when the Germans counterattacked, as they did in that early stage of the Third Battle of Ypres, and pushed the British back, he led the assault to push that counterattack back and regain the ground that had been lost. He became the last of 18 officers in his battalion to become casualties that day, out of only 19 that had gone into action. So only one officer from that unit walked away unscathed in that fighting of the 31st of July and the early days of August of 1917. And in terms of the men, the battalion had lost 473 out of 593 who had gone into the attack. So casualties in the 2nd, 5th Lancashire Fusiliers in that opening stage of 30 were very heavy indeed. He was brought back wounded from the front line there at Wiltshire and brought here to Mendingham CCS, and he was visited by a chaplain. Bess Dunkley whispered to him that he hoped that the general commanding the 55th Division was not disappointed with what his battalion had done and not disappointed in him. When this message was conveyed to the general in question, which was Major General Sir Hugh Udwind, who commanded that division, he instantly wrote to Bess Dunkley, "I am very much touched. Disappointed? I should think not. Indeed, I am more proud of having you and your battalion under my command than of anything else that has ever happened to me." Sadly, Bess Dunkley died of his wounds a few days later on the 5th of August 1917, and his battalion and his leadership inspired a book that was published called At Ypres with Bess Dunkley. And I've put a link to that. There's a digital version, a Kindle version available for free. You can download and read. You can pick up a first edition of it, not cheaply, but it's quite an interesting read. It was published under the conditions of censorship during the war, but it gives some interesting descriptions. And this is an account of his funeral. Bess Dunkley was buried at Proven. The funeral was taken by Padre Newman. As the body was lowered into the Flanders clay, General Udwind exclaimed, "We are burying one of Britain's bravest soldiers." The battalion buglers played the last post, and the spot where the hero lies is marked by the traditional little wooden cross. Later on, the King presented the Victoria Cross to the Bess Dunkley family. Bertram's wife stood in front of the King with their young child in her arms, and the King rather touchingly pinned the Victoria Cross to their tiny baby son's chest and proclaimed it as Daddy's VC. That Victoria Cross was sold at auction in 2022 for just over £300,000 and is now in the Ashcroft collection, which hopefully means it's on display at the Imperial War Museum. When we look at the cemetery around where Bess Dunkley is buried, we notice that the headstones are very close together, and in most areas they're touching. There's close, compact rows of graves here, because this, like many other casualty clearing locations, they dug trenches in the areas that were selected for burial grounds, for cemeteries, to bury the dead in side by side. And probably like Dozingham and like Bandagem that we'll visit later on, these men are buried in coffins, in inverted commas. Not elaborate coffins or ornate coffins, probably just basic wooden boxes. They were brought in, having died on a theatre or on a ward, placed in a coffin and then brought in here for burial and buried side by side, which is why we've got these very compact, very close together rows of headstones. When we look at the burials that are in here, we find in this cemetery there are four teenage Tommies, four 17-year-olds from different units, including one from the Royal Naval Division, buried in the cemetery. And by 1917, and these are all 1917 casualties, it's very unusual to see teenage Tommies. And If they're 17-year-olds in 1917, they've been in the army since the pre-conscription days, probably. So that means we're looking at lads who perhaps joined up as young as 14 or 15 and had served in some of the earlier battles of the war. The whole concept of youth, really, over 100 years ago at the time of the Great War, was very different indeed. What 17-year-olds did then is very different, thankfully, to what 17-year-olds generally have to do today. At the other end of the scale, when we look at ages of soldiers, because it's not just young soldiers, there are older soldiers as well. And there's two 56-year-olds buried in this cemetery. Now, that's my age giving it away now. And I can't imagine being in an infantry battalion. And one of these was James Maule, who was in the New Zealand Rifle Brigade, who died of his wounds on the 16th of April 1918. How a 56-year-old ordinary soldier and all the things that ordinary private soldiers had to do, tough work, labouring, digging, carrying, all that kind of stuff, how you did that at 56 years old in the generation of the Great War, which you really would have been considered an old man then, I have absolutely no idea. And all credit to him being a volunteer and having served in previous battles of the war as well. There he was when he could have been at the fireside at home. There he was in the very front line doing his bit and paying the ultimate price for that. The other thing that you notice as you look across, in particularly in this cemetery, at the cap badges, is a large number of gunners, men from the Royal Field Artillery and the Royal Garrison Artillery. Both of those units had gun sites in this area, mainly Royal Garrison heavy guns immediately around where we are at the moment, and then more towards the frontline area of the Royal Field Artillery. And because the enemy were always seeking out those battery sites to try and destroy them, the gunners had a lot of casualties. The infantry often called them thousand-mile snipers. They were so far behind the lines and they had cushy jobs. But in the gunners, they suffered a staggering number of casualties in the Great War, something you often see reflected in cemeteries like this. And there's quite a lot of Royal Flying Corps other ranks, so ordinary soldiers in the Royal Flying Corps buried in here. I mean, there are pilots as well because there were aerodromes in this area. But the RFC other ranks are not necessarily ground crew. Quite a lot of them are signallers from the Royal Flying Corps who were attached to artillery units. There was a shortage of signallers in the artillery in 1917, and a lot of RFC signallers got transferred into them. A couple of Great War veterans that I interviewed living down in Sussex were Royal Flying Corps men who were trained as signallers in the Royal Flying Corps to operate with sending signals that are coming down from aircraft off to relay posts and so on, and they found themselves then being attached to artillery units as part of forward observation teams on the front line. And because forward observation teams always had heavy casualties because they were right up in the forward zone of the battlefield, that's reflected in the graves that are here. One other grave that caught my eye when I had last visited this cemetery was that of 2nd Lieutenant James Dick MM of the 9th Battalion Durham Line Infantry. He was a working class lad from Gateshead who died of wounds on the 28th of October 1917. Now, he was serving as an officer, and the MM indicates that he's been commissioned from the ranks. And when we look at his service details, we discover that he joined the 9th Battalion DLI as a private soldier before the war. He was a pre-war territorial, came out with the original battalion and took part in the Second Battle of Ypres in April 1915 and then served on the Somme, most likely wounded on the Somme where he got his military medal and then was commissioned in May 1917 as an officer in his regiment and came back to serve as an officer in his old battalion, which was a bit more unusual, in 1917 and died of wounds during the Third Battle of Ypres. Now, he didn't go to an approved school. He wasn't privately educated or anything like that. And this was kind of typical of how the army was changing by 1917, that they'd changed the Army Act. And now you didn't have to have gone to one of those selected schools to serve as an officer. And they could draw on the experience of ordinary soldiers like him and then make them officers and make them good leaders on the battlefield. So these cemeteries, once again, are like time capsules that tell us so much about the rich history of the Great War. And we'll continue our journey through the Flanders countryside now to our third and final cemetery in this trilogy of CCS cemeteries at Bandagem. Our third and final cemetery that connects us to that trilogy of CCS locations, in this case Bandagem, is tucked away down a side road away from the village of Haringey, just in the western part of Flanders and very close to the French border. You can see it just across the fields from the cemetery itself. So this was the last kind of tiny little pocket of Flanders, part of that pocket that had not been overrun by the Germans, and really part of a tiny pocket of Belgium that existed following the German advances across Belgium, gallant little Belgium, in 1914. And in terms of the location of the casualty clearing stations that were here, it was set up so that it had that link back across the border into France to the medical establishments that were further back towards the coast. It's an area of narrow roads, small villages. Haringey is only a very small village close by, and those flat open fields with the hop poles that we see that are so reminiscent of this landscape here in this part of Flanders close to Poperinge. The cemetery appears initially to have started earlier in the war as a French burial ground, possibly from that 1914-15 period, when the French were the ones who were actually holding a big chunk of the position of the trenches around Ypres at that time. The British sector was to the south. It began around the village of Saint-Éloi and went down towards the French border and across towards the Le Bassée Canal in northern France. So there was a lot of small French burial grounds on different parts of the battlefield here that were later closed and moved into French cemeteries, like the one at Poteza, or taken across the border back into France for a reburial in family graves, or in a French national cemetery. I know there are men who were killed in Flanders buried in Notre Dame de Lorette, for example. The British connection and the British establishment of a burial ground here began in July 1917 in that approach to the Third Battle of Ypres, when, with the other dressing stations at Dozingham and Menningham, the preparations were made for the forthcoming offensive for the Third Battle of Ypres. And in July 1917, the 62nd and 63rd casualty clearing stations moved into this area, and burials from casualties of men who died in those CCSs were made here at that time. And this continued, burials continued on this site up until the fourth and final Battle of Ypres, and the last casualties were buried here in October of 1918. It's a smaller cemetery than the other two. You remember that Dozingham, where we started, had over 3,000 burials. Mendingham, that had over 2,000. This cemetery has just over 800. And when we break those down, we've got 741 from Britain, 36 German burials, 11 New Zealanders, 7 South Africans, 6 Canadians, and 2 Australians. And there are also 2 identified casualties of the Second World War and 3 unidentified casualties from World War II as well, again from the fighting that swept through here in the withdrawal to the French coast in May of 1940. Like at Mendingham, the headstones are very, very close together here. And again, it's that common practice in a lot of CCS locations where they establish a burial ground rather than bury the men in individually spaced graves. You see this not just here in Flanders, down at the Somme Highly Station Cemetery there is a good example of that. We've done a previous podcast on that cemetery. Then a trench is dug, the men die, they're placed in coffins, and they're brought in here for burial. And gradually, tragically, they fill those trenches in with those who have died. And at the time, the crosses would have been placed very, very close together. And when it came to making this a permanent burial ground, the headstones were placed close together, touching each other as well. So we see long rows of almost continuous headstones indicating how these men were buried more than a century ago. Then one of the things that linked the casualty clearing stations back to the hospitals on the coast was the railways, that war by timetable when trains played such an important role in the movement of things on the battlefield, whether that was logistics, ammunition, supplies, or in the case of hospital sites, to move the wounded on ambulance trains back to base and coastal hospitals. And in this area, there was a big network of railways that were run by the Railway Operating Division of the Royal Engineers. And when we visit cemeteries like these, we often find their graves. But here there is an unusual triple burial of sappers from the Royal Engineers, from the Railway Operating Division, of 3 men who were awarded the Albert Medal. The Albert Medal is not a military medal as such. It was awarded to military personnel as well as civilians for saving lives. and it was eventually replaced by the George Cross in 1949. So to have three men buried side by side who were recipients of the Albert Medal is perhaps unique in a military cemetery from the Great War. And we've got the particulars of what happened involving these men from the London Gazette of August 1918. And it mentions the three men who were buried here: Company Sergeant Major A.H. Furlong, a DCM, Sapper J.C. Farron and Sapper G.E. Johnson, all Royal Engineers from the Railway Operating Division. They're all buried here at Bandingham. And two other sappers who survived, Lance Corporal Bigland and Sapper Woodland. And this is the account of what happened here in the spring of 1918. In Flanders, on the 30th of April 1918, a train of ammunition had been placed at an ammunition refilling point, and after the engine had been detached and was being removed from the train, the second truck suddenly burst into flames. Furlonger immediately ordered Bigland, the driver, to move the engine back onto the train for the purpose of pulling away the two trucks nearest the engine. Bigland did so without hesitation, and the engine was coupled up by Furlonger, assisted by Farron, while the burning truck was uncoupled from the remainder of the train by Woodman. The two trucks were then drawn away, clear of the ammunition dump, it being the intention to uncouple the burning wagon from the engine and the first wagon, and so to isolate it with the object of localising the fire as far as possible. The uncoupling was about to be done when the ammunition exploded, completely wrecking the engine and both trucks, killing Furlonger, Farron and Johnson, a member of the train crew, and seriously wounding Bigland. Had it not been for the prompt and courageous action of these men, whereby three of them lost their lives and one was seriously injured, there is not the slightest doubt that the whole dump would have been destroyed and many lives lost. So three posthumous awards of the Albert Medal to the men buried here, and two to those who survived. An incredible episode in the history of behind the lines on the battlefields. It wasn't just about bombs and bayonets on the very front line. There was bravery in areas like this, which we see testified to by these graves here in this silent city in Flanders. The cemeteries that are behind the lines, like these three that we've visited, do give us these insights into units that we don't always encounter on the battlefield. And buried slightly to one side in this cemetery is a little plot of four men from the Chinese Labour Corps who died in the autumn of 1917. Now, the Chinese Labour Corps had been formed that year where they'd recruited in British trading protectorates and places like Hong Kong over 100,000 Chinamen to come and serve as labourers on the Western Front. There was this massive need for a labour force on the battlefields, and Britain had gone to all corners of its empire to recruit those men: British West Indies, South African Native Labour Corps, Fijian Labour Corps, but even those were not enough, they needed more. And the Chinese Labour Corps was formed to fulfil this role. Now, most of its casualties, and you'll find them in quite a few locations on the landscape of the Western Front, and there are specific Chinese cemeteries, as the Indian and Chinese Cemetery at Ayet and the famous Chinese Cemetery at Noyelle on the Somme, but you'll find a lot of handfuls or isolated graves in quite a few different cemeteries. Some of them from Chinese Labour Corps soldiers who were killed in the battlefield clear up after the war, when the ground was cleared and men were killed by the movement of ammunitions and ordnance across the battlefield area, but the vast majority died of influenza that was sweeping across Europe at that time. So unusually here, these ones who died in the autumn of 1917 appear to be battle casualties, if you like. Men killed either going up to the forward area of the battlefield to carry out labouring tasks there, or killed coming back from those duties. So they are somewhat more unusual in the history of the Chinese Labour Corps. And there are quite a few books on this now, and it's probably about time that we kind of covered the Chinese Labour Corps in detail on this podcast. So that's something we'll kind of look at further down the road, he says, promising another episode. But cemeteries like this, like away from the battlefront, they are incredibly important for seeing the diversity of different units that served within the British Expeditionary Force and the range of duties that soldiers had. Like I say, it wasn't all about the fighting in the very front line. To keep those frontline soldiers there, there was this big group of different men with different tasks: drivers, men who operated the trains, the medics, the labourers, all of that was necessary to keep that mighty powerhouse of the battlefields in place, to keep it going. And their role, their war, is just as important as all the others. One of the battle casualties who died of his wounds in the casualty clearing station here is a battalion commander. He's the most senior officer buried in this cemetery, Lieutenant Colonel Hubert Podmore, who commanded the 12th Battalion of the Middlesex Regiment. He died of wounds on the 31st of December 1917, aged 30. He was known as Bertie or Podders to his friends, and he was the son of parents who'd opened a prep school for boys in London in Edwardian Britain. He himself had been educated at Rugby, one of the top private schools, and he'd met the poet Rupert Brooke there as a young man. Their paths went in different directions, and Podders, Bertie, he went off to Oxford and later taught at his old school at Rugby. When the war broke out, he was commissioned into the Northamptonshire Regiment, and he served with the 6th Battalion on the Somme in 1916, where he was awarded the Distinguished Service Order. He was later then transferred to the Middlesex Regiment, and he joined the 12th Battalion as their commanding officer. But he was killed only a few days later after taking command when there was an ammunition explosion. Now, we heard from the story of the trains with the movement of ammo. It was a dangerous task during the war, having these massive ammunition stockpiles, and the movement of shells had dangers, inherent dangers. And there were quite a few explosions in this area around Poperinger during that 1917-18 period. And Podmore was one of those who became a casualty during an ammunition explosion. It seemed to have happened on quite a regular basis. You can imagine big stockpiles of ammo by the side of a road, and then a long-range German shell just pitches over and sets it off. It's going to cause casualties. And he, sadly, was one of those, being killed on New Year's Eve 1917. Like Beresford Vivian, his original cross from this grave also survives. It's at St. Paul's Church in Grange-over-Sands in Cumbria. And we've followed now three cemeteries which immortalise fictional names of casualty clearing station locations from the Great War. Bandingham here, Dozingham and Mendingham. Kind of immortal names, really, that connect us to the pathways of the Great War. And when we stand at Podmore's headstone and think that the cross, the wooden cross that stood here for those few years before this cemetery was made permanent, and we think back to Beresford Vivian's and how his cross survives back home, back in our modern world, the echoes of the Great War still survive, connect us, link us to these places here across the landscape of the Western Front, those unexpected encounters we have with the Great War at home that pull us back once more to the old front line. You've been listening to an episode of The Old Front Line with me, military historian Paul Reed. You can follow me on Twitter at SomCorps. You can follow the podcast at Old Front Line Pod. Check out the website at oldfrontline.co.uk, where you'll find lots of podcast extras and photographs and links to books that are mentioned in the podcast. And if you feel like supporting us, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/oldfrontline, or support us on Buy Me A Coffee at buymeacoffee.com.